I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Simon DeDeo. He's a research fellow at the Santa Fe Institute. He'll be presenting the film Sneakers. It's part of the Science on Screen series. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
So you did a Science on Screen movie last year, and it was remarkably similar in some ways. It was written by the same people. And that was called War Games, and this one is called Sneakers, and they're both kind of hacker films. How did you choose this one?
I think we're sort of going through the greatest hits of the late 80s and early 90s, which was when I was just beginning to get interested in the sciences, beginning to learn mathematics. I had my first computer around that time. I put on Facebook, actually, that we were going to do Sneakers this year. And the number of comments that I got from people who are now professors at Caltech or running art museums in the sciences, a lot of us saw these movies when we were kids.
Right.
They're very playful, but there's an intellectual side to them as well. And I think a lot of us kind of kept those archetypes in mind as we went on to build our professional careers.
Now, Sneakers, we're not talking about the shoes. What are sneakers?
I'm not actually sure where the title came from. The theme of the movie is doing what's unauthorized, breaking rules. And in this case, the way you break rules is by knowing the true rules deeper than the people who are running the show. And so there's a sense that all of the action, both for good and bad in the film, happens because people are able to circumvent, re-describe, reinterpret the rules they've been given by society.
And so, I mean, we're talking hackers.
Right. We are talking hackers. Yes.
We're talking about people, and I rented the DVD and I watched the special feature called The Making of Sneakers.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Which actually does kind of define what these types of people do. And in the movie, what they are is they're people who, if you have a supposedly unbreakable security system, you hire these sneaker guys to see if it really is unbreakable and see if they can break into your system. Mm-hmm. And that's what these guys do. But there's a kind of like dark side of the intelligence community system theme to it because, mm-hmm. I mean, what you have is deep, top secret, bordering on evil kinds of mm-hmm. characters floating around in the background, and you're never sure who anybody is or what their motivation is.
Absolutely, yeah. It's funny you say the word hacker. I mean, hacker used to be a very fun and friendly term, and so people would, you know, at MIT, where the word originated, it was used as a kind of pride, as a, you know, am I really a hacker? Am I a true hacker? And the people that are somewhat depicted in Sneakers would have been called in the past crackers, people who broke into things, who were maybe more morally ambiguous.
So hacker was morally above cracker.
Yes, that's absolutely right. So, and at some point, I think when the fact that computers not only ran the world, but were also at the mercy of, you know, 13-year-olds, when that sort of penetrated the mass consciousness, the word hacker was basically used to serve for both usages. So I think there are some people at the Institute who would certainly describe, the Santa Fe Institute where I work, of course, who would describe themselves as hackers. But there's no legal problem with that.
Now, one of the questions that the movie brings up is, I mean, there's all kinds of encryption that exists in the real world and that is part of this film, but is there such thing as an unbreakable code?
There is, interestingly. There is a provably unbreakable code. It's called a one-time pad, and it's almost perfectly useless for real-world applications. One-time pad is where, for every message, you and the person you're sharing that message with have a secret code book. And that code book has to be as long as all the messages you intend to exchange later. So the one-time pad, you can prove, is actually unbreakable. But it would require us to have a phone book that we shared with our bank and a phone book we shared with Amazon.com. And we don't actually do that. And also, that phone book cannot be seen by anybody. It has to be kept in your safe, and you can never reuse it. The place that one-time pads were used was in World War II. A submarine commander, for example, would keep a stack of one-time pad ciphers in the vaults, under his stateroom next to the brandy. And one of the things that you had to do if your submarine was captured was set fire to the one-time pad, because as soon as they had that cipher, they could decode everything. Instead, today we have to use things that are not provably secure. In fact, that rely simply on solving hard problems, problems that we think are so hard that they won't be solved until the universe expires, but you never know. There might be, as in this film, there might be a Russian who figures out the right way to solve those hard problems.
And do those that we use now have to do with very large prime numbers and things like that?
Absolutely. So public key encryption is the engine of commerce at this point. I'm not quite sure what fraction of the economy relies upon it. I wouldn't be surprised if it was at least in the tens of percent. But the basic idea is, yes, so I have the number 10, 10 factors into the two primes, 2 and 5. And you can use that relationship to encode a message that requires that you know only the number 10. But in order for that message to be decoded, you have to know the 10 factors into 2 and 5.
Which becomes very hard when those numbers have 27 digits.
Exactly. So it's a very hard problem. It's not actually the hardest kind of problem, which is interesting, but it is a very hard problem. And we think, by and large, that it would be cheaper just to go, I don't know, instead of stealing someone's wallet using this method of factoring a prime, you should probably just get a real job.
So the film has encryption, and it has hackers, and it also has a great conspiracy theorist who's one of these sneaker guys played by Dan Aykroyd, which is a very amusing character, because this is a guy who believes that Kennedy is still alive, for example.
Yes, I think there's a number of really beautiful cultural things that this film picks up on, not just some of the culture of hackers and some of the ways in which hackers are found, and in fact some of the people in this film are historically accurate in the sense that they actually correspond to figures in the hacking movement in the 70s and 80s. And one of the things that captures Dan Aykroyd's character is a classic example of this, is the sort of somewhat crazy Asperger's-like character who's really good with machines and can form really reliable beliefs about mathematics, but when it comes to forming beliefs about other things, the social world is completely at sea. So that's a character trope that you'll see all the time. And in fact, there's a number of people in the computer community who are almost at the level of Dan Aykroyd in terms of their beliefs about things that the rest of us take for granted.
And, I mean, it's really an all-star cast, this movie Sneakers. Robert Redford, Sidney Poitier, Dan Aykroyd, David Strathairn, and River Phoenix, may he rest in peace. Mm-hmm. I think this movie was made the year before he died. And Mary McDonnell, who I know from being Captain Raider in The Closer, which is my favorite police series. And she had a great part in Battlestar Galactica. And Ben Kingsley, who's kind of a villain, but not totally a villain. And so it's not just about these themes of hacking and information technology and all that stuff, but it's really a kind of fun caper movie.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that comes up in this film is that it's not just about factoring large primes, or rather factoring large composite numbers into primes. It's also a film about the social world in which we live and how that social world is being changed. And so this cast, I mean, they're all great actors. In this case, I think they all somewhat play characters that are easily recognizable to, you know, a 13-year-old. One of the lovely things, and you see this in the actual history of hacking and computer systems, is one of the main weaknesses of any system is not the machine, but the person behind the machine. And so I'm not sure if you do a census of all the puzzles that get solved in this film. A big chunk of those puzzles that get solved are how to manipulate not computers, but people. And so the different characters, one of the pleasures is watching all of them interact with the wider world in ways that they're not con artists, but there's something close to the con that plays a role here. So it's been described as the Ocean's 11 of the computer era. And I think that's actually right. Certainly Matt Damon in Ocean's 11 somewhat corresponds to River Phoenix's character, for example.
So would you say, just on the level of the math and science part of it, that it's realistic? I mean, for example, there's one scene where a scientist is in the front of the room and he's covered with numbers basically that are being projected onto the screen and onto him, and he's saying all this stuff that I didn't understand a word of. Is it nonsense or is it realistic?
So a lot of the science that shows up, a lot of the side remarks that show up are accurate. And so, for example, one of the central features of the plot hinges on the idea of factoring composite numbers into large primes. And without a doubt, that discovery, which is the sort of MacGuffin in the film, that discovery, if it were made in real life, would generate the same level of drama, if not more, if it actually happened. You know, in terms of the day-to-day depictions of what it's like to be a scientist, it's probably not, or, you know, a engineer in the computer field, it's probably not that accurate. So we don't actually project things onto our faces to see them, right? Hollywood has always had a problem of how to depict the use of computers because it's tremendously boring to
right.
watch.
It's the same thing about Hollywood having a problem depicting artists and writers because what their lives look like is super boring. They just sit there and do little things, and they're mostly in their heads, and it's not bodice busting,
tearing corsets apart, and throwing typewriters through windows. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. No. There's. They've had a problem. The one film, and maybe we'll do this next year, is that has a really accurate depiction of what it's actually like to do science is Contact, the film that Jodie Foster played a major role in. Carl Sagan wrote that, and they had a lot of graduate students and postdocs on the consulting committee. So that's actually a. It's lovely to watch that film because it really is accurate. Sneakers is much more the Disney version of what it's like to think.
And it's also, I mean, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, artistic license in the sense that the blind guy ends up driving the van. And
so that character is a real world character. I actually can't remember his real name, but he was called Mother in the film. And there was a young man who was able to whistle. He's blind. He was able to whistle with perfect pitch. And back in the day, our phone system, after they got rid of receptionists plugging things into sockets to connect people when they went to the first computer systems, a lot of it was done by tones. And one of the classic tones was 2600 hertz. And Mother, at least as he's depicted in the film, was a young man who was able to whistle these tones into a payphone and get free phone calls for his fraternity at the University of Florida.
Well, actually, as I discovered in the making of
Sneakers,
that guy was called Captain Crunch because he discovered that the little whistle that you get as a prize in the Captain Crunch cereal box was that same tone.
So if I can tell a funny story, my first scientific publication was actually pseudonymous. And it was when I was 16 in a magazine called 2600, which was then called the Hacker Quarterly. And 2600, that single tone, 2600 hertz, you play it on the Captain Crunch whistle. If you're good, you can whistle it. It was also, it formed the name of this Hacker Quarterly. It was also how Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak first made money when they were putting together the Apple IIe, which is they built what are called little blue boxes. And these blue boxes would play the 2600 hertz tone down the payphone. So, you know, to do that today, well, you can't actually play that tone down the phone anymore today. But at the time that they were doing that, of course, they were essentially selling a tool that would hack the phone company and get you free phone calls. So it's a number and a sound that's played a huge role in the origin of the world, of course, we live in today.
And just as an aside, if you want to talk about a movie in which the phone company plays a major role, check out The President's Analyst by Ted Flicker, who lives here in Santa Fe and made one of the greatest political satires of all time, which heavily involves the phone company. But anyway. So, I mean, here you are, Simon DeDeo from the Santa Fe Institute. We're talking about Science on Screen, which is the series that happens at the CCA several times a year, and you're doing the one tomorrow night. Have you ever been or wanted to be one of these hackers?
I sort of came of age at the point where a lot of these things were becoming less possible. I graduated from high school in 1996. That was, I think, the same year that Netscape was released. It was when computers finally went mainstream, that the personal computer was not just a fun toy to play with, but also something that you might use to buy something online, that you might use to use, you might check your bank balance on. And so a lot of the early anarchy had gone away at that point. For example, you could not use a blue box to get free phone calls anymore. there was a funny story. Somebody actually tried to use one, and the operator came on and yelled at them and told them to knock it off. So a lot of these systems were getting locked down, and it was much harder to have the kinds of adventures that it was possible to have in the 1980s. Although still, I mean, we used to meet in the basement of the Citicorp building on 54th Street in New York, and still there were a lot of secrets that were secrets only because nobody had the manuals to learn what they were. And so one of the big things people used to do, even in the 90s, was go to a dumpster behind the AT&T building and just get all the manuals. How does the phone system work? The chances are that you're more motivated to find a flaw in the phone system than an engineer who's been hired to do so. But certainly by 2000 or so, these systems had gotten much more locked down. That said, there's always an opening. There's
always a way.
Well,
there's still 13-year-olds hacking into the Pentagon from time to time.
There are, and you know, maybe I'm just old, Mary Charlotte. I guess it still happens. It must still happen. Certainly the Anonymous, the group that was involved with WikiLeaks, that group was presumably quite sophisticated in what they were able to do and what they knew how to do. I know our sysadmin, Nate Matheny at the Institute, deals with break-ins all the time or attempted break-ins to, I mean, the Santa Fe Institute's a small place. We don't really, you know, we're not that exciting, and yet still people try to break into that system all the time. I don't know. It seems less classy than it used to. It seems much more commercially focused than it used to, much less about exploration.
Why is that culture, it was, is, and perhaps always will be, dudes?
Oh, ho, ho. That's a tricky question. This comes up quite a bit when we talk about computers in society. There's a case to be made that it wasn't always dudes. So actually, we were just out of Indiana and talking to a professor there who has written a book called The Computer Boys Take Over. And so early in the history of the computer, most of the programmers were female. When that became more prestigious, the men took over. And so using machines, using technology has not always been a male-dominated system. Certainly when I knew the scene, it was mostly dudes. In fact, I think it was almost all men. I don't know what it's like now. I know there's a lot more understanding of how to get women into the scene, either informally or formally. But you raise a really tricky question.
Well, why don't we leave it on that note? Mm-hmm. Simon DeDeo is a research fellow at the Santa Fe Institute. He'll be presenting the film Sneakers. Simon, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.